Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much indeed for coming this lovely summery day, thankfully. I'm Pamela Kember, the Head of Arts and Learning here at Asia House. Actually, this is the first of our wonderful summer programme, so it gives me great pleasure to bring Joe Farrell to Asia House from my old hometown of Hong Kong, where I used to live for almost 20 years, so things have changed, but certainly not the practice of binding women's feet in China. For many years, it's been called a brutal symbol of female subjugation, barbaric, a grotesque mutilation of the foot. This was the words of the American cultural anthropologist Susan Greenhall, who's also been actively researching the practice of the book, in her book, Bound Feet, Hobbled Lives, Women in China, which dates back to the 10th century. But what of the women themselves, their lived experiences, and the psychological as much as the erroneous physical impact on their bodies? Certainly from starting even as young as the age of 5, I believe. So this evening we have the great pleasure to introduce the award-winning documentary photographer and a cultural anthropologist, Joe Farrell, here with us to discuss her long-term project, Living History, Bound Feet, Women of China, to give us an insight into the lives of the few remaining women, but also to share how such encounters have impacted on your own life, and also the research that she's been undertaking to date. Jo's mentioned in the past that she's hoped that when completing her project, it will be a very important or useful aid for anthropological studies, which I'm sure absolutely it will be, as much as an important visual history of a practice that literally unfolds many personal narratives. But also, there's a deep insight into the living history of women. All their names are mentioned, Yang Jing, Xiang Yong Ying, Wang Xiaoshen, among over 50 women, I believe you've spoken to, and probably more, whose lives were altered, we might add, ironically, for better or for worse. We look forward very much to sharing our time with Jo and presenting us with what has been described by Beverly Jackson and Michael Kenner in the book Living History, Bound Feet, Women of China, as astonishingly beautiful images. So Jo will begin with a 20-minute introduction, then into conversation with me for a similar amount of time, before we then open it up and encourage you to respond to her work and projects. Also, some of you came earlier, we have copies of the books with glimpses into some of the women that she's come to know, which will be available for sale after the event. So please, may we warm welcome for Jo Farrell.
Thank you everyone. Can we turn to the PDF, please? That's where it disappears. Okay, so this is straight from my recent presentation at TEDx in Hong Kong for TEDx Women. When I discussed with Pamela, we decided that I would start off by just giving you a brief introduction, a 15-minute introduction into what I have been working on. When I've done my TEDx talk, I have originally described or started with perception. What actually happens is that we make judgments about people, and as soon as you meet someone, the research says, you form an opinion about them. So while you've all been sitting there looking at Pamela and I, you've actually been creating a judgment or opinion about us. It takes 30 seconds to make this judgment about somebody from the way that they walk, they talk, or they dress. I read an article 2 weeks ago that TED says somebody makes or forms an opinion about a TED speaker within the first 7 seconds of them speaking or arriving on the stage. So the reason why I start with this is because my project about women with bound feet, whenever I mention that, people will say, that's such a barbaric, ugly, horrible project or custom or tradition. But the fact of the matter is that I want people to look further than that and to look at the women themselves. And so that's why I want people to make sure that when they're making a judgment about somebody, that they're looking further than the original or initial discussion. My passion is photography. I love every part of it. I love processing the film, being in the darkroom, composing an image in the camera. And one of the things about that is I use black and white film. I'm a traditional photographer, an analog photographer. I use a Hasselblad, which is what is shown behind you. Oh, behind me. Sorry. That it takes square format images, which is hence why all my images appear square. I believe that a photograph should not be cropped. It's kind of old school, but it's what I see in the camera is exactly what I intended to photograph and show you. So that's all part of photography, the traditional way, which is also a tradition and culture which is dying out. So I one of the reasons I became a photographer, as my family will attest to, is that I hate having my photograph taken. And I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way. So it was much easier to be behind the camera lens rather than in front of it. And because of my projects with women and traditions that are dying out, that I started looking at why and how we change ourselves, we modify ourselves, we make these adjustments. Why do we actually do it? So, this is, I'll show you some of the slides, and this is because I want you to understand much more about women with bound feet and to think of it in the broader tense. The women from Asian descent, the number one cosmetic surgery is a double eyelid procedure. And that is where you can see from the second, the bottom image, where a crease is made in the eyelid to make it appear more Western, or there it is cut on the side of the eyes to broaden them. It is believed it's more of a rite of passage rather than it's something that is unusual, that quite often teenagers will go through this and they think it's just normal. Over a million procedures of double eyelid surgery were done last year. That, I mean, standards of beauty all vary from culture to culture, and you must be more aware of that. I mean, we all struggle with negative thoughts about how we look. I think that, you know, I don't think I've found anyone ever that has not had some, you know, think they have flaws or they have issues with the way that they look. So standards of beauty do vary from culture to culture, and they are also deeply personal and embedded in a culture. These are the Kayan women in Burma, and they wear brass coils around their necks, and they put on more brass coils as they get older. But I want you to think of their place in their community. I also want you to think about the pride that they have, having achieved this. So even though we do not understand it, we have to respect other cultures and traditions for what they do. Attractiveness can be seen in many different ways. Breast enlargement, a lot of people do find is attractive. You know, I think sometimes it can look a bit alien. But there's also that in today's world, people like Victoria Beckham, they're actually having breast reduction after having an enlargement. But it's, you know, I'm sure that the Kayan women would think this is extremely bizarre. But it's the number one global surgery with over 1.75 million women having breast enlargements in the last year. And on the increase is pectoral enlargement for men. But that is also increasing. This is your average chicken. A lot of people usually love this slide. It's what this is about is that we feed our food, our animals, we feed them with pills to enlarge them. The typical average chicken will be fed something like a Yogi pill, and what that does is it increases the size of the breasts, it makes a more succulent thigh, a juicier breast, a bigger hips. These pills are now being sold and in South Africa, where beauty is more about being a larger person, a more voluptuous, a more curvaceous woman, than in some cultures where they prefer like a wafer thin or a thin woman. So you have to think about what we're actually putting in our bodies as well. A woman in high heels, that's, you know, women, when they wear high heels, quite often they feel more feminine, more powerful. But we also have to think about what it does to our body. In more recent times, there has been a lot more cosmetic foot lifts or facelifts. There is a procedure called the toe tuck, which is performed in Australia and America, or is known as the Cinderella procedure, where when you have the foot, the small toe, the bone is shaved so that women can wear more pointy shoes. There's also procedures where you can have Botox inset into the pads of your feet so that you can wear high heels. Or you can actually have like the middle toe shortened so you can have beautifully symmetrical feet that are aesthetically pleasing. So these all, what do they have in common? What they actually have in common is these are different ways in different societies and cultures that people will change themselves. And it's not just women that do that, it's also, it is men coming increasingly more, that they change themselves to be aesthetically pleasing, to fit in, to be part of their society, to find love, to be loved, to be married, to have children. All of these things are done so that we can have a better life. So I was talking to Pamela earlier, and I added this slide, which is not usually, it's in another presentation that I do, because we wanted to talk about the actual, what happens to a bound foot. So you can see on the left-hand side at the top is the typical foot, and on the right-hand side is a fairly typical bound foot, and you can see the skeletal structure of it. Below that is actually a picture of one of the women in my project, Zhang Yongying, who is 103 years old. And you can see that there's kind of like a crevice between the toes and the heel. Because what happens, and what I wasn't quite expecting with bound feet, was I thought a bound foot. I mean, I went in there, you know, with my own preconceptions of what I thought bound feet would be. And I went and found that the big toe is left out and all the small toes are underneath the sole of the feet. It is then a bandage is wrapped around the back of the heel. And what happens then is that the toes, the metatarsals, are pushed closer towards the heel, creating this crevice. And so the arch of the foot it goes upwards, and that's how the small lotus foot actually was created, was it wasn't just of reducing it in length, they actually reduced it in width by binding the toes underneath, and they reduced it by increasing the height and pulling it upwards. Why was foot biting done? And a lot of it was done to San Gong Si Ling, which is about the three obediences and the four virtues. And this was not to do with Chinese philosophy and the way that you lived your life. That it was important that you did what was best for the community, for your society, for everybody else, not just thinking of yourself as an individual. And so what is typical in the Chinese culture is that you honor your father, you honor your husband, and you honor your sons, and you put them first above yourself. So I talk about judgment. This woman in my project, I first met her in 2008, and she is a lovely old lady. I saw her last November, and I took this photograph, and she told me that she was too ugly, that now she was old, she was no longer beautiful. And so all her smile lines and all her the happiness in her face and her, you know, disappeared because she felt that now she was old, that she was no longer worthwhile. And it's kind of like who decides what our worth is and who decides what our value is. And she's such a lovely woman, it was just very sad. So for the past 9 years, I have been documenting women in China with bound feet. They, you know, as I said, most people consider this a barbaric tradition, and they shy away from looking at my images. And so what I've been trying to do is tell more of the story, to look beyond the feet, to actually look at the women themselves. And what I've learned is that this was a norm in their society, and that although, you know, foot binding did not happen all over China, it was mainly in the central area, the central provinces, rather than in the southern areas, which are more rice farmers, or in the northern areas near the Mongolian border, and where the Mongols did not agree with it. So it was mainly Han. And what was also learned about it was that most people believe it was the elite. They were the ones that had their feet bound. And that's a lot to do with the books and the information that is out there, that most of these books talk about the beautifully embroidered shoes and the life of luxury that these women had. You have to understand that the majority of the women in my project, and that so far it is up to 50, they were all rural farmers. They were peasant workers who worked in the fields for 50 or 60 years, and that they did not live lives of luxury. Although some of them, most of them made their own shoes, and Pamela and I will talk about that. They did this with pride, that they will, even though foot binding was banned in 1912 with the formation of the Republic of China, and it continued on until 1949, which is when the Cultural Revolution Mao came into power, and that he actually forcibly made the people stop having their feet bound. So these women have had their feet unbound for 50, 60 years. But they, of course, you can't take away from the actual shape or form of the foot. It will never grow back. And most of them, why I say that, they do say with a sense of pride that their feet were smaller, as they will hold up their fingers and say, but my feet were like this, you know, when I was 18, 19. And I believe it is that they, you know, they achieved something. And you have to also realize that in their lifetime, they are the generation, the last generation of women with bound feet. They did this to attain beauty, but they're also the generation where everyone turned against it. So if you can imagine that you were, everyone really loved having their feet bound, that you, the mother-in-laws, the matchmakers were all the ones that wanted you to have your feet bound, and then within years, you were told that was one of the worst things, and you were criticized for it, you were shamed for it, and embarrassed about it. So going through those two emotions in your own lifetime, I think, would have been pretty difficult, even without the Cultural Revolution and the Great Famine. So the previous one, this is Zhang Yongying, and she's the first woman I met in China who had bound feet. I had a fortunate conversation with a driver in Shanghai who said that his grandmother had bound feet, because originally most people said there was nobody left alive who still had bound feet, which is not the case. I was talking earlier with Helen Person, who's the curator of Shoes, Pain, and Pleasure at the V&A, and she said that when I had written to her, she was amazed because she had been told by curators in China that there was no more women left with bound feet. So when I my information popped up, she was very surprised and wanted to learn more. So Zhang Yongying, she's an incredible woman. She was the first woman I saw in 2005. I see her every year. Last year I saw her twice, and she's you know, just an amazing, amazing woman. And the next one, this is Su Shirong. And she is one of my translator's grandmothers. And she was known as the most beautiful woman in her village because she had the smallest feet and those perfectly formed. So she had had beautiful feet, but she also said, because of feudal traditions, that it was imperative. It was the only thing they could do to have a better life, to actually get married, was to bind their feet. This is Man Shen'er. She bound her own feet, and this is something I've come across more and more. So when we talk about this was forced upon women, you have to think about that a lot of these traditions are done by the women, they're done by the mothers and the grandmothers, or the daughters do it themselves, to themselves. She was 7 years old when she bound her own feet. And she bound her own feet because she had seen her mother binding her feet, so she learned how to do it from her mother. And she said all the other girls in her village bound their feet. She wanted to fit in. She wanted to be beautiful. She wanted to have a future. She wanted a better life. So she did it herself. So it's not just a tradition that was forced upon them. It was something that they actually decided that they needed to do in order to get a better life. So, I typically find parents or mothers that cringe when I start talking about buying feet. Like, how could you do that to your own daughter? And it's like, what mother, what father would not want their child to have a better life? And this was one of the only ways that they could. So that's mainly, I'll now pass over to Pamela to ask me some questions. And please feel free to ask me any questions as well at the end about what I've just shown you.
Thank you, Jo. That's really an interesting introduction. I guess from my point of view, it's also about beginnings in terms of the dating of foot binding. We mentioned before that it was as early as the Song Dynasty, 10th century. There's many stories or myths, let's say, about the subject. One I read was it was the ruler Li Yu, who was in China between 961 and 975, who said his heart was captured by a concubine, Yao Niang, a talented dancer, who brought her feet to suggest the shape of a new moon and performed a lotus dance. I mean,
that is the most popular story about how and when foot binding started.
But I was going to ask, how did you become interested in this subject?
In this particular subject? I had been documenting or photographing traditions and cultures that were dying out, and I had an exhibition at the Hooper's Gallery in 2006, and I asked various people if they could give me some constructive criticism about my work, and they said what I needed to do was to focus. I needed to actually have that my work was too generalized. It was Tibet, it was Cuba, it was China. And so I was like, okay, as a woman, I'd like to cover more women's traditions. So I thought, having been in and out of Asia for the last, 25 years, that first one that comes to mind is foot binding. And I thought, well, there can't be anybody around that it is still have their feet bound. And that's what led to asking around, and everyone saying no, until this driver turned around and said, my grandmother has bound feet.
And that was the beginning of your journey?
Yes.
9 years, is it?
It's actually, I think it's 10 years now, but 9 years since I first took the photographs.
Okay, well, let's focus a little bit on the women themselves, and you mentioned earlier about the sort of class system. I was reading upper class women were carried either by servants or in sedan-style boxes, to stop them from having to hobble or use a cane. But then the lower classes had to just flutter about to try to walk to keep themselves. So there was this sort of idea of where you are in the
pecking order, yes.
Society. But also within families, apparently normal-footed sisters would grow up to be bond servants or domestic slaves for, when they're old enough, for the concubines of rich men or wives, but able to work in the fields alongside their sisters who weren't bound. So there's this kind of idea of one family member becoming...
I haven't actually heard about that. I mean, I think that there's I mean, if you, I don't know if you've seen, like, today there's an article in the Guardian about my work, and like, one of the things the journalist Jack Mills actually wrote about was that there was a whole ritual about binding your feet, and that they were soaked in flowers and, you know, goat's blood and perfume and urine and all kind of what to actually soften the feet. None of the women I've come across have that. And so there's a lot of the books, it's wherever you go in China, there are different stories. And so, I'm just taking it from the women that I've documented. And most of them I found in Shandong province and in Yunnan province. And there are definitely different stories. Because I've also heard, like, the elite, when they had their feet bound, there was a special machine that I believe that there's a shoe museum in outside of Shanghai, and they have this machine which would unwrap the bindings to go around the feet, so the servants didn't have to do it with their hands. They used a dryer. A wheel dryer to actually put it around. So I don't. What I'm trying to say is, I wouldn't believe everything you read.
But some of the dates that you mentioned, young girls as young as 5 years of age, 7 years of age.
The youngest I've ever was three. There was one that's five. Mm. The majority of them were like seven. Many of them were like 15. And there wasn't any guidelines for foot binding. They, you know, you just had to follow. What your mother was showing you. With these images, I mean, for instance, these are two of the kind of best formed, if you like to say, feet. I mean, when I met Zhang Yongying, this photograph was taken within an hour of meeting her, so the one on the far left, and I held her foot in my hand, and it was so soft. All my preconceptions about bound feet disappeared. I felt real empathy for her, and I realized that part of it was what she had been through to attain this beauty was quite incredible. And so from that, you know, you can see that not all the feet are the same. There wasn't guidelines to a great extent, although there is one book I've read. There's multiple books on foot binding that I have read that actually has diagrams of how foot binding was done. But it seems that, you know, especially in the rural areas, they would just take up and bind their feet as best they could.
And you mentioned that many of the bones were broken for years, but there is a healing process. As much as some toes were missing, some feet, as you mentioned later, once they were released, there was something of a process of becoming a little undone, or they were still...
Well, part of... if you can imagine, so the toes were underneath the sole of the feet. And what actually would happen is that the young girl would be made to walk on her feet, to put her weight on those feet, and that's how the bones would break. So the first year was excruciating. There's no denying that. There was a lot of... not just pain, there would be a lot of infection, and after the first year, they became kind of numb. And now, 50 years on, you know, they say that they don't really have many problems with their feet. These are 80, 90-year-old women, and the main medical problems that they have is similar to any older person. It's normally they've had a stroke, they've had cancer, they have glaucoma, they have Alzheimer's. None of them are actually physically to do with their back, legs, hips. There's two or three women I've met who have fallen and broken their hips, and so they've been bedridden for years, 7 years, some of them. But that would happen to anybody, not just if you had bound feet.
And I was told that during the winter months was probably the best time for young children or girls, because then it would be so cold, their toes would be numb, so they probably wouldn't be able to feel quite so much what on earth's going on.
Yes, and especially like in the peasant families. I mean, I've been there, the last time, as I said, was in November, and it was cold. And some of these ladies were, you know, they don't have central heating. There's also in, you know, some of the rural areas, the local government won't turn on heating until a specific day in winter. And so I was staying in this little motel, and I was like, it's freezing. Can you, you know, I can't get the heating to work. And they said, oh, no, it's, you know, not the 15th of the month yet, so we'll turn the heating on then. So I was like, okay. But one thing I wanted to add about that was, so when they unbound the feet, that was painful. They had already learnt to walk with their feet bound and, you know, changed completely their gait and everything. So they had now had to, when the foot was unbound, they had to relearn to walk. Not only that, they had to learn to walk with their toes underneath their feet. So a lot of them say that unbinding was just as painful.
Well, let's go back to beauty for a moment, because obviously many young girls use foot binding because it was a mark of beauty and one of the main avenues, we're told, for women to find husbands. But also, I also think it might be about keeping women in their place. I could be wrong, because you're talking about the farm workers, they've got to go out to work in the fields. But I think there's also this notion of keeping them at home, being vulnerable, not being able to run away. I mean, you know, I'm using that as a sort of metaphor.
Yeah, it was. I mean, for a woman to have their feet bound, it was considered they were more subservient. It was also considered that if a woman had her foot bound or her feet bound, that she would be a good wife, because she wouldn't complain. She'd already been through this very harsh tradition, so she was very unlikely that she was going to be a bad wife or make problems.
But maybe I can open that up in a moment, but is there any research that's done, for example, on how many foot-bound women married well? You know, statistically.
Yeah, but it's not just, you also have to think about that in the rural areas, that if the mother-in-laws or the matchmakers considered it would be good to have the feet bound, then they could marry into a family who had more land, or maybe they had more sheep, or maybe they, you know, it was like a dowry. It was like your daughter was a commodity, that the only way that, you know, you could better yourself in your life is by doing that, by having their feet bound. So it's not in terms of, no, they didn't become rich and live in bigger houses and stuff, or luxury. And the difference was is that they had a better life than potentially otherwise they may not have had. But also, if they didn't bind their feet, they would have a horrible life. They would be disowned by their own family. They would not be able to get on and have children, get married. So it was a means to an end.
Interesting. But, you know, the whole sort of idea of the devotee towards the foot binding, I think, as well, in literature, in poetry, I've read this, the praise for the essence of female fragility, for example. And according to the American author William Rossi, who wrote The Sex Life of the Foot and the Shoe, 40% to 50% of Chinese women had bound feet in the 19th century. And for upper-class women, it was almost 100%. If we can really believe those figures, it's quite extreme.
No, it's pretty... Well, I think it's also, you know, it depends on what province or area they were in. But
as you said, some provinces it's not...
Yeah, so provinces, it didn't happen. The southern provinces and northern provinces, it happened more central. But it is like anything, forbidden fruit. So a woman with bound feet was forbidden fruit, or her feet were forbidden fruit. So nobody apart from her husband would see them. So therefore it was considered erotic, it was considered exotic. There's a lot of research of prostitutes who had their feet bound, because men would, you know, want to go and see something they weren't allowed to touch, to taste, to smell, and it was all kind of all the senses. There was a lot of prostitutes who did it.
Mm. Because you mentioned the ideal foot, 3 inches in length, is that right?
Earlier that's what it was, the lotus foot, the golden lotus would be 3 inches long, which I, of course, have never come across, but I think that's more to do with, I think the younger the woman was, the smaller the foot, and also if they didn't have to work and they were more of elite status, rather than these older ladies who unbound their feet.
And apparently it was the ultimate erogenous zone that...
Well, that's what the men said.
Well, yes, but this is interesting because apparently there are a lot of erotic manuals at the time that listed 48 different ways of playing with a woman's bound foot.
I mean, that's part of it. So there is... I don't typically talk about the erotic side of foot binding because I want to actually celebrate and be sensitive to these women. And I think there's been enough... Most of the books talk about the eroticism... And I just think it's just sensationalizing it more. And I would rather be telling, as a photographer and cultural anthropologist, I would rather be telling their stories so that future generations actually know more about women with bound feet rather than, you know, there's 48 positions with a bound foot.
I'm also thinking, how did they experience that, some of them? It must have been very difficult that you don't actually look at your wife's or your partner's feet. You just feel them. You know,
how often do any of you look at your wife or husband's feet? I mean, well, they're actually not that attractive. I don't actually particularly like feet. I mean, that is...
Well, that's interesting. So we've got golden lotuses, and then we've got silver lotuses. But also the pain, the body in pain. We can't not get away from that, despite the fact that people live with that condition. You know, it's a reminder every day, I'm sure, because the weight of your whole body, the weight of your life, is through your feet. I mean, this is the thing. I wonder, had any of the women talked about this, you know, the toil of working with those feet day in, day out?
Well, of course. I mean, they said, you know, when I have asked them, one of the questions that I ask is that if you had the choice again, would you have your feet bound? And they said, yes, that, you know, that did give me better options. But I wish I'd never had it done. But it's more because they were the generation who lived through the Cultural Revolution and through the Great Famine, and they had to work to get food rations. They had to work in the fields more and more, and they still work in the fields. So
all of these women worked in the fields?
Yes.
Yeah. And let's just talk about some of them, because you say they're amongst the most amazing, kind, generous, and compassionate women you've ever met. And in the past year alone, 3 sadly have died. And
the top 2 women.
The top 2 women.
They have passed away, and they were you know, really lovely subjects. Cao Mei Xing in the middle, she would hold on to me and would not let go. And it was when I met her, I suddenly realized that there is this whole thing about age, and that when you are older, you become invisible, and that these women in the villages, they had become invisible. Although they had had maybe 8, 9 children, life was going on around them, and they were no longer part of it. And I come along, and I'm interested in their stories and want to know more about them. And they, you know, can become like the stars of their village. There's a Western person who wants to come in and speak to Cao Mei Xing. And you know, she wouldn't let me go. And I had to say to my translator, I don't understand what's going on. And my translator said, she doesn't want you to leave. Mm-hmm. She's trying to force you to stay. And I'm like, oh, it wrenches my heart. And then, you know, the last couple of times I saw her, she was being taken care of by her youngest son, and he couldn't take care of her. Mm-hmm. And the last time I went and found out that she had passed away, I was in some way relieved, because she was having such a hard life, and she was in her 90s.
Sure. So, were people hesitant initially to talk to you, or did you have someone explain your research, what you're trying to do? Were people then suddenly saying, let me tell you my story? I mean, you know, this is just... I just wonder, how did people open up, these women?
So that's kind of twofold. When I first went in and I met Zhang Yongying, and I had to explain a lot more. I said to Zhang Yongying, you know, this is a more academic, anthropological project than like an average tourist going in and taking snapshots. And I wanted her to realize that I was taking this very seriously, and I wanted to make a record for future generations. And having said that, in later times, what I've been able to do is obviously show my portfolio of my work, and then they immediately understand what I'm doing. And then also start gossiping amongst themselves. Oh, look at her feet. Oh, look at hers. Oh, my. Look what she did. So they
what
actually,
about yours? What
no, oh. They have. Don't. Yes, we're not going to discuss my feet. See, now you've lost my train of thought.
Look at her feet, look at your feet. They were making comparisons to
each other. They were making comparisons. Oh, so, but then, what I was going to say, that the biggest issue I have is the adult children. Now, sometimes they're in their 70s, and they don't agree with it. They don't agree with the project, and that's the biggest issue that I have. And it's because it doesn't reflect modern China, and that's one of the reasons why they say, you know, I believe they say that there is no one actually anymore, any survivors left with bound feet, is because it doesn't reflect modern China. It's such an old tradition that they want to forget about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm making it more, bringing it to the forefront again, especially when you're in The Guardian and The Telegraph on the same day. So, yes.
So let's move a little bit on, because we haven't got much time, and I'd like people to respond as well. But let's talk about the outlawing of the traditional foot binding, because although we went back to the 10th century, it did under, I believe, this day in history, February the 1st, 1902, the Empress Dowager Cixi outlawed foot binding earlier. And then in the era under 1949 with Mao, the two issues were banning foot binding.
Sun Yat-sen also banned it in 1912 with the formation of the Republic of China.
But what I'm getting at, it still people continued?
Well, it did continue. I'm just thinking, everyone's looking a little hot. Should we open one of the doors?
Is it hot? Yeah, it's getting hot.
Some of you are looking a little bit hot. Mm. I just want everyone. Okay, yeah. Okay, so yes, so the... As I mentioned when I was showing my slides earlier, that you know, the opium trade did help to a certain extent. There were Chinese reformers prior to that. But what happened also was Christian missionaries came in, and they were the ones, as the Westerners, going around into rural areas and stopping the practice. Now, when it was banned in 1912, this stopped it in the cities. So you typically could not find people in Beijing or Nanjing or Shanghai with bound feet, but it carried on in the rural areas. And that's why in 1949 that there were actually people, anti-foot binding inspectors that went around, and they went around the rural areas and forcibly shamed people by hanging out their bandages outside their windows so that all their neighbors, all their community would know that what they were doing, or, like, you know, make them embarrassed. And several of them, not one of these ones, several of them used to wear, actually, no, Cao Mei Xing did. She unbound her feet about 3 years before she died. And I was, like, saying to her family, like, why, she had them bound for so long, why did she bother to then unbind them? And they said it was because she was so old, she had difficulty binding her own feet. So, as I say, so it carried on in rural areas. But there's a great story. If you're into reading books about bound feet, there is a book called The Small Woman. It's written about a British Christian missioner who was called Gladys Olwood. And she went to China on her own volition. That she couldn't. They didn't want her to be a missionary. And she traveled over by boat and train and stuff. And she arrived in Shanghai in the late 1930s. And the local government said, "Could you be an anti-foot binding inspector?" So this book is all about her. This book was then made into a film. The film is called Inn of the Sixth Happiness, and it stars Ingmar Bergman, and it's very well known. And it's also about Gladys took 100 orphans over a mountaintop to get away from the Japanese at that point, who were invading in the late 30s. Gladys Allwood, though, was not happy about the movie for two reasons. She was a short, fat Cockney being played by Ingmar Bergman. And she was like, this is not right. And another reason was they called it the Inn of the Sick Happiness, which the actual inn was called Inn of the Eighth Happiness. And if you know anything about Chinese culture, then number eight is considered as wealth. And so Hollywood decided it should be six instead of eight. And thirdly, she decided, what happened was, Gladys Allwood fell in love with a Chinese general who was played by a Westerner in the movie, which you're saying this is just ridiculous. So that's a great book and movie to watch if you want to learn more about it.
And actually, there are many other books. Pearl Buck, there are. I mean, she wrote a book on, I think it was called The Good Earth, which leads to
Good
the topic.
Earth, yeah. And, there's a lot of them. That. Everyone always says, the secret fan, but it's kind of more, kind of glamorized, I think, a bit more in like that.
Well, maybe that's a good one for me to end on in terms of my points, is the glamorization of the bookbinding industry in terms of shoes. Because obviously, and timely, is that you're here when they're just about to open at the Victoria and Albert Museum, the exhibition Shoes, Pleasure and Pain. And of course, we come to the actual footwear, which I read, really, the making of these shoes is incredibly intricate, beautifully hand-embroidered, but in time-consuming to make. But a recent headline I read was, special shoes for bound feet women is now a thing of the past, because they're closing down anywhere that ever produced these shoes, if you'd heard that yourself.
Oh. We've lost the screen. Sorry?
So the last shoe
factory closed in 1999, and that was in northern China. There is a place in Malaysia, that a little shop that still makes shoes, but it's more, I think, of a tourist attraction that he does that. The beautifully embroidered shoes and delicately made were all for the elite. None of the women, well, not quite none of the women, most of them have very hard-wearing either leather shoes, or several of them have given me shoes. One beautiful pair which is made out of straw, and it looked like clogs, but that's particularly good for the snowy weather. And most of them are small cotton shoes with the soles are made of tires. The women in Yunnan have much more embroidered shoes, and they typically will always make them themselves and are taught from a young age to embroider, and that was part of the way that they could, when they were young, they would stay at home and do embroidery. So yes, I think it's more the elite. We've lost bound feet, have we?
Yeah, I think it might come on. But while that's reconnecting, I'm going to suggest that anyone would like to cop yes already.
Well, just before we do that, I want to point out two other things. So alongside my book, which obviously is outside, the reason why it was designed in that way is because I started a separate project, which was about... trying to work out what's going on there. Footprints. And so Pamela and I are just going to show you the footprints at the moment. This is a side project that I'm doing, which I'm hoping a museum or somebody would actually pick up and take on. So these are, you could hear me in the back, is that I also, just hold the end, these are footprints I've been creating with. So at the moment, I've done seven books, which are has 12 women in, and they are obviously the left and right feet. And you can see in the different ways that the feet were bound. But you can, most of all, you can see like the toes underneath. So in this generation, I mean, some of them are like perfectly formed, but some of them are much longer. I mean, the lengths that they've actually gone to achieve this beauty. So this is a project which is kind of ongoing. If you want more information about it, please ask me, because I'd love to tell you.
I think this is such a poignant idea of the imprint remaining when the person is no longer with us. I think that's a wonderful tribute.
Yeah, these are all made with, you know, the chops, the stamps that you actually put in the red ink. So this is the red ink. I went to this little art shop. The little art shop and kept buying more and more of the red ink, and then would go through the whole process. Another thing that I'm coordinating at the moment is a diary. And this diary is of the trip that I took last September. And it has actually my iPhone pictures of my days, a whole month in China, and how I found these women and what the process was. So if you're interested in this, let me know, because it's going to be a hardback book, but it's going to be more about the food that you eat, this is donkey pancakes, the date farming. So it's all about, you know, some of the people. So it's a much more intricate, this is me doing the footprint binding, and she put, one of the ladies put her foot down on the newspaper so that, you know, she didn't get it on the floor or anything. And then I thought, oh, God, that, I really like it with a newspaper behind. So, and this is the actual process of making these prints. So, on that note, yes. Are there any questions?
Yes, the lady on the left with the sponge.
Maybe a couple of ideas wrapped in one longish question. Just choose pleasure and pain exhibition has opened.
Oh,
right. Yes, I've examples of models.
The bindings?
Yes, how long were they? Was it cotton silk, and were they off the peg? How did they fit in? That's four questions.
Okay, most of the time, I don't remember all of those. Most of the time, they were cotton bindings. Quite often, they were sewn into the cotton bindings so that they would remain in. I mean, the actual, what would happen is they would bind the foot. The shoes were typically made by themselves, not bought, although there were some factories that made them. After the first month, they would bind the foot, or the first couple of weeks, they'd bind the foot even smaller and put them in a smaller template shoe. And then they would create another template that was smaller and smaller and smaller. And so over time, they actually reduced the size. As I said, the 3-inch Golden Lotus, I have never come across that. That you know, they're all, you can see, they're much bigger than 3 inches. But these women have had their feet unbound for 50 years odd. And they were farmers. And so I don't know so much about the elites, which most, I think, your questions are pertaining to, because there are no survivors. I mean, one thing we were talking about earlier was, were there other countries that actually did this? Now, when I know of even one woman in San Francisco, a friend's mother who had bound feet in San Francisco, and that was because of the immigration, especially during the Cultural Revolution. There was a lot of women that went to Malaysia, and so it's mainly a Chinese culture and people emigrating.
Did they make their own bandages?
Yeah, the bandages were just like a bandage where you wrap your leg in. They were just a long piece of cloth. I mean, most of them will say, you know, they will just gesture to me. They'll say, a long piece of cloth. I'm like, okay, yes, and they just wrapped it around.
Somebody over here, yes. Just could you kind of wait for the microphone, just because for everybody to hear. Thank you.
Yeah, just a practical question. Gaining weight.
Very good question.
And pregnancy.
Well, most of them, they had their children in their fields. They didn't get time off. It was, you know, they. Yeah, it's a. One thing that has happened recently is I showed you Sushi Rong, who had the most beautiful feet in her village, was known as most beautiful woman. When I saw her in September and November, to get to down the road in her village, she got an electric tricycle. And I was like, what's going on? And the fact of the matter is she had put on a lot of weight, and her small ankles and her beautiful feet could no longer hold them. And, you know, it's not typical in a lot of the peasant families not that to put on excessive amount of weight. They're, you know, there's obesity doesn't happen a lot in those areas. But she makes great dumplings. So I think that might be part of the problem. And her two daughters are just turned 60, and they are now retired. And so I go around there, and they just keep making me dumplings. So I can imagine that she's that and eating lots of winter dates. That she's funny. Yes?
This is more of a general question, but a lot of the examples that we use at the beginning, kind of flies, women with breast implants, it seems to be kind of all these restrictions on movement for beauty all apply to women across different cultures. Would you say that's a woman's fault for trying to attain beauty, or would you say it's more of a result of misogynistic?
It is, you know, misogynistic culture, but I think it is, I mean, today we have a huge problem today that the media is so much more accessible, that it glamorizes the way that women should look. And I think that we, you know, as I get older, I believe that we should embrace more about what we look like, that we shouldn't necessarily conform to what the press says, because I think they're completely unrealistic. I think it's actually insane. Maybe it's the maturity, I've realized that now. But I think it's a lot to do with also the media now and the press, that it's pushing that. Is that?
Yeah, I just wonder why you think it's before the media.
Well, I think it's the relationship with men and women, typically, you know, that, you know, a woman typically, as I say, typically a generalization that they want to please the man, or to, you know, and the way that they do it is buttering their eyelids and wearing high heels. So.
And you had a question about that.
I'm just wondering whether you asked this lady about the pain, because of course this is your foot broken, and you think that mothers are doing it to little girls from the age of 5 and 7. The pain and the screaming that goes on with that. I wonder if you got me into what these ladies went through to survive that, and then how to work the heels.
It's also very difficult. I mean, you know, I think with Chinese culture, they don't really want to express their own story or complain about something that was considered the norm. So that they would do it in generalization. They would say it hurt. It was, yeah, there was pain. But then they would turn around, oh, but I've had a great life. And it was just, you know, it's not something they are going to talk about. I mean, it's also slightly difficult at times. There was once I had this male translator. I'd met him on a bus, as you do, and he wanted to practice his English. And he said, next time that you come back to this area, call me and I'll take you to my village. So the next time I went back with him. And he was helping me interview this old lady, and I have discovered now it is much easier to do it with a female translator, because the men get very squeamish. And at one point, there was one woman who started crying when she was telling her story. And he said to me, "We have to stop, we have to stop. She's all upset, we have to stop, poor Nana." Like, and I said, if she did not want to tell us her story, she wouldn't tell us. And that's the whole point, is that even if it is upsetting her, it's because she knows that she wants other people to hear about this. And it's important, and that's what she's thinking. So, you know, I think, but it's very much a cultural thing not to discuss the pain.
Yes, one here and then two more at the back.
Any of these ideas of the wrongness of the framing of them. if so, did they ever say, actually, this is ugly, or this is something that I wish I had done? You spoke about that a little bit, but I was wondering if you did it again. And the second part of my question is, has there been any nostalgic resurgence of the finding?
No nostalgic research. They basically, I believe in mainland China, they basically want to forget it happened. They want to forget it happened. I mean, they don't want to talk about it. More of my translators is at university, and she was working, her friend is a journalist at a local paper, and she was like saying, oh, you know, we could do an article about it. And I was like, I'm not so comfortable with that, because I don't want to put the women in a difficult situation. I want to be sensitive to it, which is one of the reasons why there's only about two or three people in this room who actually know where I go to photograph, and will remain like that.
Because we've got so little time, can we just take another point at the back, and then maybe we can come back to yours, just because the lady's been waiting at the back.
You mentioned that your diary tells a little bit of the story of how you met this woman, but I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a taste of now of how you were able to seek out and find them. You know, was it all through chance hearing?
It's a lot of it is through chance hearing. It's word and mouth. It's, you know, last time I was there, we're driving around. When I was there in September, this is one of the stories. In September, I was there. And I was there for a month, and I found a taxi driver, just calling him off the street, and I said, all right, can I come back tomorrow? Can you come back the day after? And it ended up, you know, I used him and his friends for over 3 or 4 weeks. And then they knew that I was looking for women with bound feet, and they were calling their friends, and their friends were calling their friends. And then, oh, I think there's one in this village. We drive 100 kilometers up the road, and there's we find one. We did. We found another woman. There's a second woman called Zhang Yongying, who's 103. And, you know, I photograph her. And while we're going there, we're driving along, and I'm like, stop the taxi. We've just driven past one. So I'm like jumping out and running after this little old lady saying, can I come home with you and photograph your feet? And she's, yes. Yes, I'd love to be part of the project. So it just keeps going on. I just seem to now have a knack for it. And I can also tell if I drive past.
So you can spot the way people are walking.
Yes.
Well, I think because Jo's going to stay on, and maybe you can share more of your comments with her next door. Because we want to give you time to sign the books and discuss more of your ideas. But I think what is so special about this evening is that Jo is here to give voice to so many women who don't have one in society, and that she can speak internationally and give such a heartfelt response to something that at least someone is out there telling our story. So thank you very much for sharing that with us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.